Uzbekistan Diary, Barbara Jodry. The Road to Samarkand. In 1984, I joined a university-sponsored travel study program to visit the Soviet Union for 3 weeks. Key cities included Leningrad, Moscow, Kiev, and Tashkent. The final week found us in Uzbekistan, shuttling by bus between Shahrisabz and Samarkand. After Tashkent, our itinerary included several days in Samarkand. However, there were no hotel rooms available in this old Silk Route city that marked the route from Western China to the Middle East since before the days of Marco Polo, so we were flown to a small military airport halfway between Samarkand and Shahrisabz. The only planes on the ground were drab-colored military planes with propellers. No jets. From there, our tour group of 24 was bused to a hotel in the middle of the smaller city, famous primarily as the birthplace of Tamerlane, a Mongol warrior from the 14th century. Visiting this remote part of Asia in a city whose earliest history coincides with Babylon and ancient Egypt was a special thrill, but fraught with a sense of danger, as we were only a short distance from the Afghanistan border, where a war between the Soviet Union and the Taliban insurgency was being waged. In fact, we were surrounded by several little-known Soviet Islamic republics whose names ended in Istan, and whose citizens were openly resentful of Soviet domination earlier in the year. As it turned out, within 5 short years, most of those republics in the southern part of the USSR would transform into independent countries with the downfall of Soviet communism. In July, the heat is oppressive, with temperatures up to 120 degrees by day and in the 90s at night. Back in Tashkent, we'd taken to sleeping with hall doors open to avoid suffocating in our first-class hotel where the air conditioning had failed. Individuals took turns staying awake an hour at a time to be sure that unknown persons did not attempt to sneak into our rooms while we slept. Here in this small town, I took the mattress off my single bed and laid it across the open doorway to capture the slight breeze from the hallway. I slept quite comfortably with a whistle under the pillow. I'd learned from experience as both hiker and backpacker to have a whistle handy to summon help in an emergency, and it has accompanied me to more than 25 countries. At the only modern hotel in Shahrisabz, air conditioning worked quite well, a pleasant surprise after Tashkent. Since we were 80 miles from Samarkand, the plan was to eat an evening meal, get a good night's sleep, and set out by bus the next morning for a day in the city noted for elegant and ancient Islamic architecture. Natasha, our official in-tourist guide since our arrival in Leningrad, was about to get in the shower when she noticed that a large scorpion had crawled up past the drainpipe under the sink in her bathroom. Scorpions are not native fauna in Leningrad. She screamed for help in both Russian and English as she rushed out of her room, clad only in a bath towel. Doors opened up and down the hall. Ed and Dave, members of our tour group, calmed her down and killed the arachnid before it could escape back down the hole. Then they searched her room for other members of the same species. Finding none, they assured her all was okay. The manager offered to move her to another room while wide-eyed hotel employees hovered outside her door, not daring to get involved. She was clearly embarrassed by her panicky behavior, but this incident really melted her icy exterior. Her air of professional detachment was breached, and she was more fun to chat with. She no longer sat alone at the front of the bus, poring over our itinerary for the day and avoiding informal conversations. Our bus to Samarkand was a Bulgarian-built version of a Greyhound bus. We piled on right after breakfast, armed with carafes of water to cope with a 2-hour ride across the blistering plains. It soon became clear that the air conditioning did not function. At a halfway rest stop, we splashed water on ourselves, but nevertheless arrived bathed in our own sweat and coughing from the dust that whipped in through open bus windows. Once inside beautiful blue-tiled Islamic museums and mosques, the air was cool, but outside on the street, it was unbearable. Samarkand is one of the world's oldest cities. It was once a center of science and religion in the world of Islam. Ulugbek, a son of Tamerlane, built an observatory for charting the movement of the stars. This observatory was unknown until 1908, when a Russian archaeologist uncovered the ruins of a giant marble sextant. Ulugbek's input to the science of astronomy puts him in a class with Copernicus and Kepler, although his work was unknown until some written records were found in 1648, alluding to his discoveries. It took another 250 years to find his most amazing contribution to astronomy, the sextant. Day two meant another drive to Samarkand for more sightseeing, but a common-sense solution was agreed to the day before. Wring out a large bath towel in cool water at the bathroom sink, and once on the bus, arrange it over head and shoulders so that evaporation would keep us cool. It worked beautifully for the first hour. After that, the bath towels were dry and we began to bake again. Fortunately, our alert bus driver pulled into a rest stop to add water to his radiator, and we all piled out to soak our towels again in a large cistern of water by the attendant's adobe house. Relief from the heat was once more available for the remaining miles. As we were leaving Samarkand, some were able to find a place to soak towels before getting on the bus, but others were not so lucky. It was not a happy trip, except that some were distracted by the sharing of exotic souvenirs purchased in the city. Some miles from Chakrasabs, a large herd of skinny cattle blocked the highway ahead of us. The driver shifted into low gear and drove slowly into their midst, surrounded by cattle that were so close to the bus we could touch them. The herders on their skinny Mongolian ponies doggedly moved the cattle forward as though the bus did not exist. The driver yelled out the window, but the herders ignored him. There was no place to drive the cattle off the highway because of a thick fenced-in wood on one side and a deep ditch on the other. After a mile or two, the herders diverted the cattle through an open gate into a field, and we proceeded a short distance, only to have the engine quit. The driver thought that he might be out of gas. We knew that our destination was not far. In fact, some impatient male passengers got off the bus and set out on foot, arriving at the hotel an hour ahead of us. My friend Ed stayed and became the hero of the day. A man with considerable and varied knowledge of things mechanical, he assisted the driver in examining the problem with the engine, which was at the rear of the Bulgarian-built bus. After ascertaining that the gas tank had plenty of gas, he saw the problem immediately, but the driver was loath to have him touch anything. Neither spoke the other's language, but Ed was persuasive and resourceful. With gestures, he showed how the fuel line was too close to the overheated engine and that it had created a vapor lock that inhibited the flow of gas. While the rest of us paced back and forth under a thin cluster of trees, Ed took apart the fuel line, blew it out, and inserted a shunt with hose that he removed from another part of the vehicle so that the fuel line would not vapor lock again. The driver seemed convinced he would be in big trouble for allowing a foreigner to mess with the bus, but Ed told him to start the engine. It came to life and hummed contentedly. Everyone piled back on, and we rode into town just at dusk, again hot, dusty, and sweaty. The next morning, the driver was all smiles, and Ed was a hero. Not only did the driver not lose his job, but also the local bus company wanted Ed to train its mechanics. Meanwhile, word had spread that there was a mechanical genius from the U.S. in this remote outpost of communism. That morning, several local kids brought disabled bikes to the parking lot in front of the hotel. If Ed could fix a bus, surely he could fix a bicycle, and he accepted the challenge. Our departure to visit a state-owned cotton plantation was delayed while he gave kids help with their bikes. Ed was probably the best goodwill ambassador to hit Chakrasabs since Marco Polo. On the second day trip, when I dropped my heavy 35mm Olympus camera on the glass counter in a souvenir store in Samarkand, I thought it would be an international incident. The glass shattered, and several display items fell on items inside the case, breaking them also. I didn't think I had enough money to cover the damage. While the Uzbek staff conferred, I apologized profusely and paid $20 on items that I had already selected. After overcoming the language barrier to some extent, the manager accepted the $20 as coverage for the damages as well. I felt I had gotten off easy. I had no idea of the value of the destroyed items, and still don't. By far the worst event on the second day was the possible loss of my money belt, which I had accidentally left behind in our hotel room as I rushed out to the bus. I noticed it missing when we were several miles down the road, but Natasha refused to ask the driver to return to the hotel. I feared that a cleaning person would find the belt with passport and $600 in cash inside and keep it. Natasha said not to worry. The staff could be trusted. That day in Samarkand was not a happy one as my anxiety persisted. When we finally returned and unlocked the room's door, we saw that no one had been in the room since we left. It was exactly as disheveled as I had left it. Nothing had been disturbed, and the money belt lay across my pillow in plain sight. Incredible! On our last morning in Chakrasabs, we visited the outdoor market just a short walk from the hotel. I wondered if it would be anything like the outdoor farmer's market at home. The benches and wagons were piled high with fresh fruits and vegetables, familiar and unfamiliar. A vendor insisted I taste a wedge of melon, a variety I had never seen before. It was luscious. I whipped out my Polaroid camera. The Olympus was back at the hotel, totally out of film, and took a picture of the melon display and vendor. When the photo rolled out of the camera, an instant replica of him and his produce display, the vendor was flabbergasted. He thought it magic that a finished picture could emerge from a small black box, a picture of himself. I gave him the photo, and he gave me a melon. Other vendors crowded in, wanting to trade for a photo. I continued to take pictures, but in the length of time it took for each exposure to develop, more people gathered and were demanding that I take their picture. Things got a bit unruly, and it was difficult to break away and head back to the hotel, but local authorities helped clear things up. Meanwhile, we had more fruit than we knew what to do with. When our plane left the next morning from the same tiny airport where we had arrived only a few days earlier from Tashkent, the luggage contained several carefully wrapped melons grown in Uzbekistan. We were on our way to Moscow, the last stop on our way back to the U.S. 3 days later, when we arrived in New York, one melon remained still firm and luscious-looking. We had shared the others with fellow travelers. That last melon was confiscated by an airport attendant who checked our luggage for illegal items. I often wonder if he shared the melon with his coworkers at lunch.